Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending part of your day with me. Amy Sherman-Palladino and Dan Palladino have been television auteurs since the 90s. You know their work. Gilmore Girls, Bunheads, and most recently, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which since its debut has won 8 Emmys, a Golden Globe, a SAG Award, and a Critics' Choice Award. Ironically, the Palladinos' latest hit begins at the end of a less-than-perfect partnership. Here's the story. Midge Maisel has the 1950s version of having it all, a beautiful Upper West Side apartment, a spiffy wardrobe, 2 kids, a degree from a pretty fancy college, which she doesn't have to use because her husband takes care of all the bills. That is until he has an affair with his secretary, and then they gasp, they split. The end of her marriage is the beginning of something freeing for Midge. She ventures downtown to the Village club scene and starts to find her voice as an electric, occasionally profane, outspoken stand-up comic. Let's take a listen to one of those sets.
Considering you thought you were here to see Lenny Bruce and instead you have to listen to me for a while.
I promise to insult the Pope and read you my court documents before the evening is over. So, let's see. What can I talk about? I'm going through a pretty dull time in my life. Oh, my husband's girlfriend attacked me at work yesterday. You know what that's like, huh, ladies? Really? No one? Oh, good, then you'll love this. So, my husband left me 3 months ago for his teenage secretary. However, the other night he came home for some clean underwear and a actually, just for the underwear. I threw in the free. Anyhow, Lolita found out, and boy, was she steamed. She couldn't believe I'd have the nerve to sleep with my husband. She thought that was mean and vindictive. And she has a point. After all, she has a teddy bear. He won for her at Coney Island. All I've got is a wedding ring and 2 kids who call him daddy.
Amy Sherman-Palladino and Dan Palladino are in studio. Thanks for coming in, you guys.
Thank you for having us.
What was that word that was bleeped out of that?
Oh.
I don't know what that was. I don't remember.
We love Amazon. Mm-hmm. We can use all those words. How do you describe Midge, Amy?
You know, Midge is a supremely confident lady. She was always queen of her 6 blocks and kind of loved her life and always felt like her life was perfect and she scored and she got it. And then when it fell apart, it revealed a whole other set of skills and thought process that she never knew was there in the first place. And the thing that we wanted to really make sure that she wasn't a woman who was dissatisfied from the very beginning, staring out the window, having her sherry at 3 o'clock in the afternoon thinking there's something better out there. You know, I wanted her to be someone who's like, this is it. I won. This is great. So when it left her, she really felt like she had completely lost everything. And then she sort of found her superpower, mm-hmm. which is comedy and being able to get up on stage and talk about her life and talk about everyone else in her life, whether they want her to or not. And she also discovered a really strong, ambitious streak in her that has sort of taken over everything as sort of her new guiding light. So, and she wears really cute dresses.
She wears
like
great.
Such cute dresses.
Great.
So really tiny waist. And she wears hats and it's adorable. And
Rachel Brosnahan was pretty unknown to most people, not a household name when she took the role. What is it about her, you think, that she gets about this part?
When she first, you know, it's unusual. A lot of people in our business, in the comedy business, are kind of like, well, if it's someone playing stand-up comic, it should either be a stand-up comic or obviously someone who's done comedy. And Rachel had done, I think, almost pretty much no comedy.
Yeah, I think Rachel's entire career was her being kidnapped and thrown in ditches and, you know, and a lot of crying.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And to Amazon's credit, a lot of companies would ding an actress like this and just say, we don't want to experiment with somebody trying to act funny. But to us, we were really intrigued. And I think what she came in was, again, it's the confidence word. Midge is very confident. Rachel is very confident, so that really helps. Like she was holding her sides and her hands were not shaking, and a lot of actresses' hands shake. It was a big part to audition for, and we gave them three big scenes to do. So I think the confidence, and I think the sort of, she also kind of got the underlying anger that is in every comedian. And she sort of innately got that. And she's just this incredible actress who pulled off the stunt of being a realistic stand-up comic, going through all the phases of learning it. It was a really tough thing to do, and I think just the confidence is what really sold it.
And to Midge's confidence, that confidence doesn't always make her 100% likable.
Mm-hmm. No, and we weren't actually interested in that, because we had come from, you know, you spend years on network television where they're like, oh, she can't raise her voice, that's not likable. Or, oh, make sure she doesn't wear red. Red is not likable. And like, oh, the hair, make sure the hair is really likable. You know, so like the last thing in the world I ever want to hear again in my entire life is the female character likable? It's just, is she interesting? Is she viable? Is her journey something that people want to watch? And the great thing about, again, Rachel Brosnahan, who is kind of just a steamroller through life, she wasn't interested in being likable. She was interested in playing somebody very interesting and very different from what she had played before. And we got lucky that, because you don't want to have to spend half your time talking your actress into, it doesn't matter if you're likable. Mm-hmm. It's okay if you raise your voice. It doesn't matter. You're a human being. Sometimes human beings aren't likable. 90% of them are never likable. You know, at least you're going to be likable like 50, 60% of the time. That's not bad by human standards. So
yeah, and men have been pulling it off in TV for many, many years. Al from Deadwood, everyone loved him. Tony Soprano, everyone loved him. Walter White, everyone loved him. If you hated those guys personally, you would not watch the show, even though they were often despicable. There's been an obvious double standard for women characters in movies and TV, and so we wanted to make sure that you saw the foibles of this character too, that you saw that she was human and sometimes very, very selfish and sometimes very, very self-centered and maybe not the best mother all the time, as, you know, mothering standards were so different back then. We wanted to reflect that you didn't hover over your child and you didn't necessarily tell your child you loved them every day and every hour. So we're trying to do what men have gotten away with for a long time.
Ambition in women is something that I think a lot of times people think is an unattractive trait. And yet in men, ambition is how you get what you want in life. And the more that Midge performs and the more that she hones her skills, the more she realizes how ambitious she is, that she doesn't just want to get up at the Gaslight and have her Wednesday night set. She wants to be famous. She wants to take this as far as she can take it. And that's her learning, that is both a little unnerving to herself, to everyone around her. And yet, like, that is sort of the driving force now. It is like that fierce ambition is going to be pulling against her natural need to, like, do I want family and comfort and the, you know, go to the butcher shop and look cute every day and hang out with my mom in the same apartment that I grew up in? Or do I want to take over the world, which could be a lonelier, scarier, maybe less emotionally fulfilling and yet more fulfilling in some ways. So like that's going to be her pull for the rest of the series.
You said something so interesting in your answer about actresses being concerned about their perception of not being likable, even though they're playing a part. Is that really an issue for young actresses that you've run into?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, part of what's interesting that I found, because I tend to write characters who at some point are going to yell. Just at some point, usually in the pilot, they're going to yell at somebody. And I have found that it's a hard thing for a lot of actresses to do because they are so aware of the fact that behind the scenes, a lot of times they are judged on how feminine you are and how likable you are, and raising your voice and yelling is not considered a likable trait in a woman. And a lot of times you have to really tell actresses, like, you gotta yell.
Yeah, it's okay.
You're You're pissed. Mm-hmm. You gotta yell. Mm-hmm. Your husband left you. If there's any time when you can yell, perhaps this is the time. So it is a thing, and hopefully the more that parts are being written for actresses that aren't being decided on the level of likability, but more on the level like, what is the journey? How interesting is this person? Do they have a story to tell? Maybe actresses in the future will not be coming to the table with that sort of baggage on them. But it is an issue, and not for Rachel.
Rachel's good.
Rachel doesn't care. Rachel's like, I'll just go out there and you want me to kill a kitten? I'll do it. That's fine. I'm good.
My guests are Amy Sherman-Palladino and Dan Palladino. One of the things I think interesting about the show, there are many interesting things, but I like the sort of anthropological sort of excavation of New York City and this particular family at this time. There are a lot of details about this affluent Jewish family on the Upper West Side, down to like where the dad works and how they keep the house. What was it about this time period that you thought was really ripe? And if you could share a couple of details that you put in the script and in the family composition to let us know more about this family at this time.
Well, the time period was really picked because comedy was starting to shift a little bit and starting to become a little bit more talking about real things and life and politics and family and sexuality, and it hadn't been before. Comedy had been a little bit more like, take my wife, please, mm-hmm. you know. So we felt like that time period would be an interesting time to throw someone who's just starting a career in comedy, because it's straddling that old school, new school world, and especially a woman, where there just weren't a lot of women in comedy. It's tough for a woman in comedy now, but back then it was a nightmare. And to put somebody who is finding her voice, so actually talking about things is going to be important to her, and not pretending to be a character or a, you know, quaint or ugly, you know, not putting a weird boa on her, you know, and talk about a voice, you know, like that she's actually going to go and talk about being young, being possibly divorced, possibly what does she do now, children, should she have been a mother, she never thought about it before, that these are things that she wants to be able to talk about on stage. That time period felt right for that.
Yeah, and as far as the family and the whole setting, you know, we always kept in mind that, like, this is a generation and a time when World War II, like, almost all the young men walking around were World War II veterans. When Zach Levi came on last year and played the Dr. Benjamin, I don't know if we mentioned it, but we told him he is a World War II veteran. So we always kept that in mind. And of course, for a Jewish family, we always keep in mind that the Holocaust was 15 years before. And that also, not only was it the heartbreak of that era and of what happened, but also this is a Jewish family now that is prosperous, feeling safe, feeling affluent, and is really becoming a natural part of the American fabric. So that's something that we always kind of keep in mind too. And of course, Midge kind of blows it up with because of what happened to her, she decides to take a path that this family was not expecting, that this family did not want. So everything's kind of shaken up, but it is a family that was just sort of becoming like the true American family back then.
There's a lot of references to real. Lenny Bruce shows up, real people. And there's a Jane Jacobs rally.
And she's on camera.
Sure, why not?
Why not?
I mean, Jane Jacobs has not gotten her due. So.
Because, you know, the younger demographic was dying for an on-screen
clamoring.
Depiction
if
of
I could
Jane
tell you
Jacobs.
How many
Hashtag
letters
Jane Jacobs.
We got.
14-year-olds, 15-year-olds. There's such Jane Jacobs fanatics. It's crazy.
When you sit down and you work together and you decide to write and incorporate something like that, how does that come up? Is it just, hey, Dan, I got an idea, let's put in Jane Jacobs, or is it more planned than that?
Well, we discovered at the time that Jane Jacobs did have this really big rally because they were going to build a road through Washington Square Park. A lot of people don't remember that, but it was going to go, I think, through
the arch.
The arch, and the traffic was going to go right through it. And this was the stuff, this was the Robert Moses era, and this was the stuff that a lot that people had not been fighting, and the fight was starting, and Jane Jacobs was starting to lead that fight, mm-hmm. and she did lead that fight. So even the sign is, so we re, recreated that in season one, and even the signage they had was the exact signage that they had, the exact words on the signs that they had back then. So Jane Jacobs came out of like, it was a, we knew it was happening, and we knew it would be a funny thing for Midge to stumble upon. So sometimes it's just a matter of like, it wasn't really this burning desire to have Jane Jacobs on, but it just was the right format to for Midge to have some comedy, and in fact go up and do an impromptu sort of comedy routine, which she did in that episode.
Everything's got to come out of story, and like we don't want to set we didn't want to set out to do just a show of people showing up and doing impressions. You know, that's not really what the show is, because we're building our own reality here. But at certain times, there are certain touchstones. You know, Lenny Bruce came about because he is sort of the example of the new comedy and the new way of thinking. And it felt like he would be a good muse for her and a good, somebody to emulate up to a certain point where, you know, it sort of went wrong for him, which we haven't hit yet. But at this point when he was really somebody talking about things, it felt like that's a good touchstone for her. And so we threw him in the pilot sort of as that representation. And then, of course, we fell in love with Lou Kirby and he's such a great actor, and it just felt like it popped up a lot more, like times to bring him back. But you know, just as much we make up, you know, the Jane Lynch character who plays Sophie Lennon, she's not a real character. She's sort of, we took bits and pieces of other, you know, ideas of other female comics and sort of
Sophie Tucker, the Reformation of that name.
A little bit. You know, Phyllis Diller would go home and paint, you know, it's like, and she'd be very,
and
you
lived
know,
in Bel Air.
Yeah, live in Bel Air, you know. Joan mansion. Rivers had these beautiful antiques that she cared about, you know, and really wanted to be a serious actress. So it's like we took sort of bits and pieces of these other comedians and sort of put them together in Jane Lynch. So basically it's all about us. When it suits us, we'll do it, and when it doesn't suit us, you know, screw it.
My guests are Amy Sherman-Palladino and Dan Palladino. I heard you say it earlier when I was watching a roundtable interview that you were on of writers, just your joy of not being at a network.
My God.
Let's put it in the positive, shall we?
Hallelujah.
So for civilians.
Yes.
Let's say you were doing this show for a major network. Think about a scene or something that you wanted to do that, and how that would have gone at the network.
Well, this show could not have been done at the network.
Period.
No, they would never have been, in a gazillion years, they all would have said, oh my God, we want to do that show. And that would be the end of it. They may have even gone so far as to pick up a pilot. And then you try to cast it, and that would have been the end of it. I mean, it's.
And then they would damn you, like if when they call you to tell you that your project's not going forward, the first thing they say to people like us is, "I love the writing. I love the writing is so amazing." And
I know,
and Amy and I look at each other like,
"Oh, we're
dead.
We
are sunk.
We've just dead. Been canceled. It's all over."
You know, we're still schmucks with Underwoods, but. It's really like there's a lot of reasons why this character went, you know, because you see this character and you think, oh, she's so sweet, she's so likable, and her journey is interesting to me. But they would not like a lot of aspects of it. They would not like her ambition. And I'm saying traditionally, you know, the networks. I don't know who's at the networks now, because we haven't worked at a network in ages.
And we never will again.
But we came up in a system where basically we're not going to tell you exactly how old we are.
But you can guess.
We're the same vintage.
It's something like that. Yeah, but we came up at a time when basically there were like four networks, and it was an extremely conservative business. And we're not just talking about now we can say curse words on TV, which has positives, but you don't have to. All in the Family was a great show. It was on a network. They never said a curse word. They said certain words that we don't say anymore. But there have been great, great, great network comedies, great network shows. But generally,
not in a long time, though.
Because, not in a long, long time.
The thing about the networks that people need to understand is networks are run by the marketing department. And that is the basic difference. When the marketing department, the people who have to sell soap, are making creative decisions, and that is the bottom line, then you're screwed because they only care about the demographics that's going to buy the Tide or buy the car or buy this. And your piece has to conform to that. There is no interest in conforming what they do to your piece. Also, they have changed the structure of television so much. When, you know, back in the old days, you know, when Dan and I and the dinosaurs roamed the earth and we first started out in sitcom was two acts. It's what, five, six acts now?
Yeah, I mean.
So they keep chopping it up and they make the actual playing time shorter to put more commercial time in. So your ability to tell any sort of cohesive story goes right out the window because every time you got an act break that you got to go to commercial, you want to try and keep them and bring them back. So you can't just take a story and then chop it up. There's got to be a dun 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 moment,
yeah. Bam. Commercial.
And then half the time, right. When you come back from the commercial, you have to take back the dun 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 moment because it was a lie because you had to put it in, and then you had to sell the soap, and then you got to continue on, and it's exhausting, and it's just not a creative way of thinking about storytelling or character or the process. It's not gratifying to have to have nobody in the sphere of power be interested in the actual creative aspect of it, because that's really not what network television is set up to do. They are set up to sell ad time. And when you go to a streaming service, they don't care. Okay, you know, Kellogg's is like anyone else. Kellogg's can figure out how to turn on the, you know, and fast forward, and you know, they're just watchers. They have no skin in the game.
Well, I think they would care more about the quality of the content because they have to entice people to come to it.
And there's
like
so
the public
many places
radio
to
model,
go.
Yeah.
The public media model. It's the quality.
Yes.
Or even the HBO. You know, it's the quality of the content that
it's
makes
not TV,
people.
It's
you have
HBO.
To take a jump.
Yeah.
Right. Like A Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is not going to have as many viewers as like Hawaii Five-0 at its peak on the network. But I have a feeling they don't share any data with us, and we don't need to know the data. But I have a feeling that like a show like Marvelous Mrs. Maisel probably draws us a certain enough people of a like interest that suit them in some way, and they let us do our thing, and it's really nice to be able to do our thing, and then it's up to us to entertain the audience. Like if people like Amazon let us do our thing, then the responsibility is on us to do our thing well, because the audience is always right. It's not right for us to like write something, produce it, absolutely no one watches. We can't say the audience was wrong. The audience was right. There was something wrong with the project. So we like having that responsibility, and we're happy to have it. And Amazon has dumped a lot of it on us, and we're appreciative of that.
My guests are Amy Sherman-Palladino and Dan Palladino. Can we talk about Gilmore Girls for a little bit?
Sure, why not?
It's so interesting to see younger generations find shows.
Mm-hmm. It's really weird.
It's really interesting.
It's so weird.
Yeah.
No one was even thinking about you existing. You know, these young people who come up to us, you know, and Gilmore Girls has no... You know, there's no Snapchat. You don't swipe left or right.
Cell phones.
There were no cell phones when we started.
Pre-internet.
It was a big deal when we had a story with like a pager. Like that was very big when you had that, you know.
State of the art.
It was just very, and so it's interesting that it's keeps going and drawing a young audience. It's nice. It's delightful. It's really, we get lovely letters that.
Yeah,
that,
I mean,
what are they connecting with?
I think we've talked about this because not only there was a huge resurgence after Netflix, but we always had a pretty strong audience on the WB, even though we were always up against the number one show on the air. We were always up against either Survivor or Friends, or
Survivor when they were going
really
against each
stiff
other.
Competition. Or they premiered American Idol against us when we got our new time slot.
Yeah,
that was fun. Like, woohoo!
That was great.
And then suddenly American Idol comes along. But I think there's an aspiration, I think, to the small town and the comfort and the coziness of that town that the girls lived in. We had a very idealistic Connecticut for people.
In Burbank?
Yeah. It was in Burbank, in the shadow of Forest Lawn Mortuary. But I even young people at the time were like, I want to live in Stars Hollow. I would like to, you know, there was an aspiration for it. And I think even now, like the absence of cell phones, I think kind of plays as, it might even be a relief to the younger generation to see kids interacting without texting, without doing everything that they have to do these days electronically. It's almost, maybe it's a little bit of a museum piece, but we do know that the small town aspect of it was comforting to people and interesting to people. It was rural. There were Republicans living in that town. You know, so it was not just like one sort of, it was a big, big, many, multi-slice of Americana, and I think that's been a big part of its appeal.
There was also the, by the way, there was only one Republican living in that town, Taylor, and that was it. But other than that,
there were others.
The mother and the daughter relationship, yeah. I think, is something that people have really keyed into. And the idea of, like, mother and daughters who really can't talk about anything else but can sit down and watch Gilmore Girls together was that's sort of a thing that we've heard lot.
For sure.
And that is amazing and wonderful. And, you know, the best letters that we get are the ones that are like, you know, this is the only thing my family could agree on. We could sit and watch this for an hour. Mm-hmm. We weren't killing each other. And then, or because of Rory, I went to Yale, or I went to Princeton, or I went to Harvard.
And, or I read Tolstoy.
Or I read Tolstoy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a couple of times you get the, you know, because of you, I went into journalism, to which we say, we're sorry.
Sorry.
We apologize. We don't know what to say.
Don't follow me home.
We'll send you a check.
I'm not going to go home until you walk away, okay? Thank you.
Are there any ideas on the shelf from your network days that you think, huh, maybe I could revisit this now that I've got this swanky new deal with Amazon? Things that at the time that maybe the people said, we love your writing, and you had to put it on, you had to put away.
How dare you say that, Allison, even just like that. No, we tend to be forward looking.
Yeah.
We don't tend to like dwell on, if it's really not good for people like us to dwell on the hurts of like, there's this project from the old days that I'd love to resurrect, because it's always better just to move forward.
Because after a while you feel like Orson Welles in the caftan.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, you're just like
sitting at Chasen's.
Yeah, you're just like at sad in Chasen's with a little dog and like trying to get like, you know, some money out of somebody to do something you wrote 40 years ago.
When did Dory Sherry die? Is that true?
It's like, that's like the image that I have every time, like, you pull a script out. It's like, don't put the script away. Put it back.
Yeah. Put it back. I believe the internet, you're working on Gypsy? Is that true?
It's there's a piece of paper that somebody has signed, and I've signed that's a cagey way of saying yes. Yes. First, I got to put Maisel to bed this year, and then apparently I'm supposed to write some words that let me entertain you.
And then Maisel to bed is the third season.
Third season.
We get to go to Miami. We get to go to Paris. Second season?
Mm-hmm. Paris. Miami. There's nothing like Paris. I mean, shooting in Paris was literally like, if I die right now, that's fine. It's totally okay, because it was as dreamy as you think it would be. It was just like magic. It was amazing. But yes, we're going to a couple places this year, and she's on tour this year, so we had to take her on tour, and everyone was excited about tour until they saw how much it was going to cost, and then they was like, oh, can she just drive to the Bronx and back? What about that tour, you know, the five borough tour? That's an exciting tour. But it's going to be good. If it doesn't kill us, it'll be great.
And you guys are back in New York. You guys return to the city.
Yeah.
Is it easier to write here?
We love writing here. We love the theater community. We love concerts. New York is the great American city to go out and do things, you know, like the rooftop movies in the summer, and ballet and theater and film forum, and it just goes on and on and on. We love we imbibe a lot of culture, and we love it. And there's
and
no
we grew
place
up in
like
the San Fernando Valley, which is basically, you know, a Ralph store, and you're out.
Once they closed the drive-in, man,
like
it was
Ralph's
all over.
I spent my entire life knowing I did not belong on the West Coast. That from the time I was literally old enough to realize, oh, the sun and the thing and the ugh. So the minute that we could extricate ourselves from LA and move out to New York, we packed up the books and we left. And that's it.
It's a lot of books.
That's it. We're here. We're never leaving.
Don't trust people who don't have books.
No, you can't.
It's ridiculous. Or stuff. Where's your stuff?
But you maybe shouldn't trust people who have too many books either. That might be us, but maybe there isn't such a thing.
My guests have been Amy Sherman-Palladino and Dan Palladino. Thanks for coming to the studio, you guys.
You are so welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Stay with us. This is All of It. We'll have more after the break.